For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. For those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site. Today is the 15th, March 15th, and we are in Parashas Ki Sisa on page 494, and we're going to try to tie up the loose end that we left from last week. To recap, we discussed the various aspects of the Egel Hazav of the Golden Calf. But we left off with trying to understand, first of all, how did this gold turn into a calf? And there we'll turn to the Midrashim to understand how that happened. How did the gold turn into a calf? But more importantly, how did the calf satisfy what they were looking for? They were looking for, as we mentioned last week, a replacement for Moshe Rabbeinu. And Moshe Rabbeinu was superhuman, as far as they were concerned. And they looked at him as not as a god, God forbid. They never worshipped Moshe, that we never find any accusation that the Jews worshipped Moshe, no such thing. But he was certainly as they saw him as the only possible human being who could have done what he did, to be the one who was their leader, the go-between between them and Hashem. And therefore, they couldn't imagine another human being doing what Moshe did, and therefore any replacement of Moshe had to be something other than a human being. So that would have been something angelic or something spiritual. So how is it that a calf now satisfies them? Now we're good. We've got this golden calf. It, no matter how strange its formation was, it's still difficult to understand how it satisfied what they were craving. So we have to understand that. And with that, or in order to understand that, we're going to tonight discuss a little bit in depth about Avodah Zarah, about idolatry in general, and what exactly was going on over here that the Jews were trying to do.
This all seems wrong to me. You say, you know, they didn't consider Moshe a god. It wasn't idol worship. But if they had faith in Hashem, then Moshe should have been able to be up there for 100 days. And they say, okay, you know, Hashem, look at the miracles he gave us. You know, so we're not happy now. He didn't come down fast enough. So, you know, we believe in him. He's the one. He did all these things. He didn't do it. Hashem did it. He did, you know, Moshe.
As I said, Chazal do not, never, never do we find the Jews accused of worshiping Moshe. You don't find it anywhere.
But that's the only thing that makes sense, though.
It's obviously wrong, because otherwise they would tell us that.
But it doesn't. We're going to have to
figure something else out. I'm just saying we can't argue with our sages. That no one says that. It can't be.
This doesn't make any sense to me.
Okay.
Let's develop it.
We've talked about this before, that the Rambam explains that how does idolatry work? We live in a time when there is no drive to worship idols. So to us, idolatry is foolish. And that's because it is foolish. That's the correct way to look at it. But that's because we don't have any internal drive for idolatry. When before the beginning of the second Beis HaMikdash, before the second temple, which is when the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah, the men of the Great Assembly, davened to remove the drive for Avodah Zarah, for idolatry, everybody had an innate drive for it, no different than any of the other drives that we have that we struggle to control. We all struggle with various types of drives. We all struggle with anger. We all struggle with jealousy. We all struggle. Everyone struggles with eating. Mm-hmm. We all struggle with various types of desires and emotions. And We don't say that a person who loses his temper, we don't say the person is foolish. We say, unfortunately, they have a temper problem. But we can all relate to what it means to have a temper problem. We can all understand that. A person is jealous. We don't say they're foolish for being jealous. We say, Nebuch, the person is jealous. But we can all relate to what it means to be jealous because we've all experienced it. With idolatry, we say it's foolish because we can see clearly it really is foolish because none of us have ever had a desire to find an idol and bow down to it and offer it a sacrifice. But before that period of time, then everybody had a drive to do that, and it had to be controlled like any of the other drives that we have. And the Gemara makes it very clear that if we would have lived at the time when there was a drive for idolatry, we would all be running, literally running, to find an animal to slaughter and spill its blood on the altar for the idol. That's we'd all have that drive. We'd all be running to do it. We'd be picking up our skirts and running. The men, you know, also wore things down. You know, we'd pick up our tunics and run to go and do it. That's what the Gemara says. So we have trouble relating to that. Rambam explains that the original development of Avodah Zarah, I mean, how did it happen? When Adam was created, he knew who God was. I mean, he was created by God himself. He conversed with God. So how did it happen that by the time you get to the generation of his grandchildren, they're already worshiping idols? Dor Enosh, the generation of Enosh, is already an idolatrous generation. They're worshiping the sun, they're worshiping the moon. So the Rambam explains that the sun, the moon, and all of the various forces that are out there are in fact very powerful forces. Hashem created them. None of them have independent power. They all are directly controlled by Hashem. But they are very powerful forces. The sun, we know a lot about the sun because of science. And we think about the sun, it's almost unimaginable what's going on the surface of the sun. We can barely look at the sun from here, whatever it is, 93 million miles away. And the sun, considering being near the surface of the sun is just an awesome thought, which none of us can even get into our brains. That sun was created by Hashem, and it's a tiny thing that he created. It's nothing for him. So it is appropriate, as we say in Tehillim, David HaMelech wrote, Hashamayim misaprim kavod kel. The heavens tell of the honor of God. You look around, look at the sun, look at the moon. It's just unbelievable what God created. And so it's appropriate to look at the things that he made and say, wow, what an awesome God. Look what he did. That's appropriate. The next step after that is to say that if God created it, then we should acknowledge it as something special. Wow, the sun. The next step is to say that, wow, if Hashem created the sun and it's so awesome, then Hashem probably wants that we should pay homage to the sun as well. And people began to say, oh, the sun is terrific. The sun is wonderful. The sun is, and it's a very small step between the sun is wonderful to, oh, sun, you are wonderful. Where you start talking directly to the sun. And slowly but surely, the mindset of people went from viewing the sun as being an incredible masterpiece created by Hashem to being something that has some form of independent power. Even though the power of the sun may not be as great as the power of Hashem, but it's a power nevertheless. And therefore, it deserves to be worshipped. And in fact, perhaps the sun can do something for me without permission from Hashem. If I bring a sacrifice to the sun, then the sun will make my crops grow. And I don't need to talk to Hashem. The sun will do it for me. And the sun is much more accessible than Hashem is, because the sun, I can see the sun. It's got some form to it. Hashem is out there somewhere, and I can't see him, I can't touch him, I can't hear him. The sun, every day it rises, it sets. I can relate to the sun. So I should worship it. And not only the sun, but the moon and the stars and the rain and the oceans and the mountains and the valleys and the grass and the deer and the sheep and the goats. And then it just goes on and on from there. And idolatry becomes this, it snowballs into this thing where people attribute independent power to anything but Hashem. So that is the development of Avodah Zarah. Avodah Zarah, we say idolatry from the word idol, but it's not only idols. It's worship of anything but Hashem. So that's how it developed. Here, what were the Jews looking for? They were looking for a replacement for Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe was leading them. Moshe was superhuman. And they needed a replacement for Moshe. Now, Moshe wasn't a god. Moshe didn't have independent power. He was a human being. But there's a difference between a human being and any other object that Hashem created. In a certain way, human beings are more godlike than the sun. Human beings are more godlike than the moon. More godlike than the stars, than the rain, than the goats, than the sheep, etc. There's something that is sort of like a god that we all share. What is that thing that we all share that makes us sort of like a god? Free will. Free will, even more than the angels. We have free will, they don't.
Yeah, they
don't. We're the only beings other than God himself who have free will. So even though none of us have independent power, I can't lift my hand without Hashem allowing me to lift my hand. I can't open my mouth without Hashem allowing me to open my mouth. I don't really have independent power. But I can make choices and decisions that God doesn't want me to make. I have the ability to sin. I can do what Hashem says not to do. No other creature other than human beings can do that. So in a certain way, a human being is like a god. That's why it is permissible to pray to a human being. What does that mean to pray to a human being? My Rosh Yeshiva of Weinberg, Zechon Rachav, of blessed memory, used to say all the time, if I say to you, would you please pass the box of tissues? I'm praying to you. That's prayer. I'm asking you to use your free will that has nothing to do with God to pass me the box of tissues. I could also ask you to do something God doesn't want you to do. I could say to you, could you please take that person's purse and hand it to me without their permission? And you can do it. Because you don't need God's permission to use your free will. Now, you'll get punished for it. But right now, in the here and now, we can all use our free will however we wish. There's nothing stopping us. So in a certain way, we are godlike. And that's why you can pray to a human being. He used to point out that the word for please is pray, right? Pray past the salt. You can say that, right? Because that's what prayer is. Prayer is, I'm asking you to do something for me that is of your own volition. You choose. I can ask God to do something for me. I can ask you to do something for me. I can't ask an angel to do something for me because an angel has no choice. An angel can only do what God tells him to do. He cannot make decisions. Just like I can't ask a goat to do something for me. And I can't ask the rain to do something for me because they're not making their own decisions. But God is and people are. And therefore, I can pray to you. Now, obviously, if I pray to you that you should give me a long life, then I'm just being foolish because you don't have that ability. But it's not because you don't have the free will. It's because no one gives you the ability to affect how long I live. But I can pray to you to be nice to me. I can pray to you to help me. If you're a doctor, I can pray to you to heal me. Meaning, do for me what you do have the power to do. So, in a certain way, a human being is more godlike than anything else. Now, take Moshe Rabbeinu, who is already as far as the Jews are concerned, and they're not wrong about this, he is essentially the most refined human being that ever walked the planet. Meaning, he's the greatest prophet, which means he's the closest to God, spiritual. He's the most spiritual being, human being, to ever walk the planet. Coupled with that, he has free will, which means that you're now flirting with confusion. And this is really what you were bringing up before. This is not idolatry, but you see how close we are. You've got, on the one hand, Moshe Rabbeinu, who is more spiritual than anything else. He's greater than the angels themselves. When he goes up to get the Torah, the Gemara explains how the angels tried to stop him, and he was able to deal with them. He was able to argue with them, and he was untouchable. Moshe Rabbeinu. So you've got this being that is the greatest of all creations that Hashem has made, and he has free will. That makes him very close to being like God. But they never worshipped him. Not in any inappropriate way. They asked him for things, but it's okay with a human being. You could ask. You're allowed to ask a human being for something. There's nothing wrong with that. Now Moshe is out of the picture. He's not here. So we need to replace Moshe. But no human being can do what Moshe did. So we need something that can do what Moshe did and is God-like. So when you take that need and you inject that into a civilization, a time when people had a very strong drive for idolatry, you can see how that can very easily slip into real Avodah Zarah, real idolatry. We're only looking for somebody to lead us. That's all we're looking for. We need someone to replace Moshe, to lead us. But if it can't be a human being, and it must be something that's godlike, well, what is it going to be? You're kind of stuck now. Where are you going to put in to that gap? It's very, very easy to slip into real Avodah Zarah.
Why didn't they pressure Aaron to be their leader?
That's the thing. They did not think that he could do it. They did not think he could be Moshe. Aaron was wonderful. He was great, but he wasn't Moshe.
No, nothing else could be Moshe.
Right, right. So that's your two choices are to settle for a lesser human being, which that would have been the right thing to do. You're absolutely right. That's from our dispassionate perspective. We don't have the drive for Avodah Zarah. Well, of course, if you don't have Moshe, okay, so you go to the next best thing, which is Aaron or some other great leader of the people. That's from our perspective. But when you're really in a mindset where Avodah Zarah is a big drive and I've got to constantly stop myself from slaughtering that animal for the idol, then Aaron's not the only choice. The other choice is some idol.
What part did the error of
okay, we're gonna get to it.
How would they expect the idol to tell them?
Okay. So now this is a general perspective. Now let's get into exactly what happened over here. So yes.
But you said you're a generation that's on Nisim and flood.
Yes. That's true.
It's like regressing back to the mindset of Mitzrayim.
Good. Okay. So,
which is what they had.
So that's exactly what happened. Okay. So now, how did this gold, which Aaron threw into the fire? Remember, Aaron was trying to delay. He was trying to. We talked about this last week, right? Delay and try to diffuse the situation, try to get the mob, break up the mob. And eventually, the thing will peter out and Moshe will come and it'll be fine. That's what Aaron's trying to do. Mm-hmm. So he takes the gold, he throws it into the fire. Out pops a golden calf. That doesn't usually happen. I mean, last time I threw gold into a fire, it didn't, right? So how did that happen? So the Medrash gives us two explanations, and they are related. They're related. One explanation is that the Erev Rav, are the Egyptians that left Egypt with the Jews. There were a group of Egyptians that were, we'll call them the best of the Egyptians, because they're the ones who were attracted to Hashem. And they came along with the Jewish people. And Moshe Rabbeinu here made a mistake. Of course, I can't say made a mistake, but our sages say Moshe Rabbeinu made a mistake. The mistake he made is he said that if these Egyptians want to get close to Hashem, it's a good thing and I should take them along. But he did not ask Hashem beforehand if he should do so. And in fact, it was wrong. Now, what does that say about accepting converts in general? So, why would it be wrong? I mean, Moshe's reasoning was, here you have people who sincerely want to connect to Hashem, so we should take them in. But Hashem said he was wrong. He didn't ask Hashem, and this episode proves that he was wrong. So what was the mistake of Moshe? So there's two things that one has to bear in mind about accepting converts which were not applicable in the time of Moshe. One is we had not yet received the Torah. We as a people were not yet solidified as a people. It's one thing that when you have a very solid core group to say, okay, this person wants to join, that person wants to join, we can absorb sincere converts. But when you don't yet have a solid core group, because we're really fresh, we just left Egypt, it's not necessarily a good thing to bring in outsiders. That might have been the mistake. The other big difference between the regular acceptance of converts and here is the Gemara tells us that in the days of David and Shlomo, especially Shlomo HaMelech, King Solomon, they did not accept any converts. Why not? Because in the days of Shlomo, everybody wanted to be Jewish. Who wouldn't want to be Jewish? The Jews were the most powerful nation in the world, the most economically powerful nation in the world. You were a Jew, you enjoyed incredible benefits. So of course people want to become Jewish. That doesn't prove sincerity. That doesn't prove they want to get close to Hashem. At that moment, when we were leaving Egypt, and the Egyptians had been decimated, and we were leaving, even though we had been slaves, but the fact is, we at that time had the upper hand. We were going out beyond Rama with an outstretched arm. We looked very, very good when we left Egypt. We'd won the battle. I mean, they were licking their wounds, and we were walking out. So at that time, it's possible that the mistake was that it didn't prove the sincerity of the Egyptians just because they wanted to go with the Jewish people. So I'm not sure which of these reasons or both of the reasons are the reasons, but it's one of these two things probably, either again because we weren't yet solidified as a nation or because things were too good for us to trust the sincerity of the Egyptians. But either way, it was a mistake that he brought them along. When the going got tough, which is when Moshe doesn't come down from the mountain, they're the weakest link in the chain. They're the first to crack. It is the Erev Rav that can't handle the lack of Moshe. Everybody's nervous. Everybody's afraid of the loss of Moshe. The Gemara tells us that the Satan came and made the world dark and confusing and cloudy, and who knows what else is going on. And it was people were afraid that this was a sign that Moshe had somehow perished. People were nervous. All the Jews were nervous. But that doesn't necessarily mean that they would crack. It could be they would have waited 24 hours. But the Erev Rav, they lost it almost immediately. As soon as there was any hint that Moshe wasn't coming back, the Erev Rav were, as we say, ice mensch. They lost it. They couldn't handle it anymore. So when Aaron threw the gold in the fire, the Erev Rav stepped forward and they used the black magic of Egypt, the Kishuf of Egypt. Egypt was full, we talked about this, Egypt was full of Kishuf, was full of black magic. We know from the Chartumim the sorcerers who were able to replicate some of what Moshe did and some of what Aaron did. But here, they used that black magic and they were able to turn that gold into a golden calf. Why a calf? That we asked this last week. If you're going to turn it into something, why a calf? Make it a big statue? Make it a lion? Make it a bear? Why a calf? Why a calf?
That was the first class you gave a long time ago before you moved, except I don't remember anything.
So again, our sages tell us that what?
The sheep versus the calf.
Okay.
Right.
That one of the primary idolatries of Egypt was the calf. That was one of the primary things they worshipped. There is a pasuk, there's a verse in Yirmiyahu in Jeremiah that says, Egla yefefia Mitzrayim, that Mitzrayim is a beautiful calf. They're likened to a calf. And I've mentioned this in class several times. We say this on Hanukkah. You mentioned Hanukkah before. We say this on Hanukkah in the Ma'oz Tzur. In the song, the Ma'oz Tzur that we sing after lighting the candles, one of the stanzas, which is about Egypt, says about the slavery in Egypt, says, Beshibud Malchus Egla. In the servitude to the kingdom of the calf. That's a reference to Egypt, because they worshiped the calf. Therefore, the most likely thing that the Egyptians would have created would be the calf, because that's what they worshiped. But it's more than that. Not only is it true that the Egyptians, once they were attracted to Avodah Zarah, they would naturally gravitate to the calf, but we had been living in Egypt for 210 years, and we were exposed to the idolatry of the calf. We had been exposed for the past 210 years. Therefore, when the calf came out of the fire and the Jews witnessed it, the Jews who were the weakest ones in their own faith, they would also be attracted to worshiping the calf. Because that's the Avodah Zarah they had been exposed to. If it would have been a different type of Avodah Zarah, it could be that they would have had a little more resistance. But here, this is what they were most susceptible to. Imagine if you have someone who is living in a place of drug addicts. He's living in a place where they are constantly on drugs, and he's very strong and doesn't succumb, but he sees it constantly, all the time. And he sees the way that what it does to people. He sees the good feelings that it brings to the people around him, but he struggles with it. He doesn't actually do it, but he struggles with it. But you understand that it's not a good thing to expose him to that, because it's something which he's weak in. It's something which he's been drawn towards, even though he hasn't actually done it yet, but he's been drawn to it. And so here, the Jews were particularly susceptible and sensitive to the Avodah Zarah of the calf. That's one explanation for how the gold became a golden calf. Second explanation is that when Moshe Rabbeinu had to get the bones of Yosef out of the Nile River after Yosef died, we talked about this in Beshalach, after Yosef died, so he was put in a coffin and they sunk the coffin into the Nile River because they did not want Yosef's body leaving Egypt. They felt that Yosef was a great omen for the Egyptian nation. They wanted to keep him there. And Moshe had to get him out because Yosef had made everybody swear that they're taking him out with them. So Moshe had to get him out. So Moshe took a tas, he took a plate of whatever, of some metal, and he wrote on the tas, he wrote on that plating, right, Alei Shor, Alei Shor, arise, O ox, arise, O ox, because Yosef is likened to an ox, to a bull. He's called Bechor Shoro. He's called the bull. That's the, you know, different shvatim are likened to different animals. Yosef is compared to the bull. And that's what it said. It said, arise, O bull, arise. So, Alei Shor, Alei Shor. Now, it's no accident that Yosef, who is represented by the bull, which means that his koach, his strength, was the strength of a bull. Yehuda's strength is strength of a lion. Dun's strength is the strength of a serpent. Right. Each one is a different one. Yosef's strength is that of a bull. It's no accident that Yosef, whose strength is the bull, becomes the viceroy over Egypt who worships the calf. Whatever it means, and you're right, this is what we spoke about many years ago, and that's a whole different discussion, but whatever it means to be represented by a bull. Whatever that power is, that's what the Egyptians worshipped. They worshipped the calf. A calf is a baby bull. That's what they worshipped. And therefore, Yosef was particularly attractive to the Egyptians because he represented that which they worshipped. And so it was a natural fit for him to be their viceroy. That same plate of metal that was used to get Yosef out of the Nile was taken by, it also had God's name etched on it, it was taken by Micha, by without getting into who Micha was, but he was a person who was not a good person. It was taken by him, and he was a person who eventually becomes an idolater for the Jewish people. And when Aaron throws the gold into the fire, he takes this piece of plated metal, throws it into the fire as well. It says, arise, Shor, bull, arise, Shor. So out comes a baby bull, an eagle, a calf. That's the second explanation that Chazal say. But you see, the second explanation is very similar to the first one because it has to do with the power of the bull, of the calf, of the cow, which brought Yosef out of the Nile. And Yosef was the viceroy in Egypt because that's what they worshipped. They were particularly attracted to that power. And so here again, when the calf comes out of the fire, the Erev Rav, those Egyptians who had joined the Jewish people, and those Jews who were less able to withstand the temptation were easily drawn to the calf. And what began as something which was meant to be a replacement of Moshe to lead the Jewish people very quickly and very easily deteriorated into an actual Avodah Zarah. It's not necessarily the case that the people said there's no God. That's a higher level of Avodah Zarah to say the only God is the sun. That's a higher level. As the Rambam explains, that's not the way idolatry started. The way idolatry started is that people said, there's God, but there's also the sun. Here, the way that the Erev Rav said it is, Ela Elohecha Yisrael Asher Lucha Meretz Yisrael, these are your gods that took you out of Egypt. It could be that they rejected God completely, and it could be they didn't reject God completely. They just attributed a separate power to the calf. In essence, what the Erev Rav were saying to the Jewish people was, it's not that God decimated the Egyptians and all of their idolatries, and now you are becoming the nation of God. In fact, what happened is the calf, which was the idolatry of the Egyptians, has now chosen you as its new nation. The calf has replaced the Egyptians with you. The calf has taken you out of Egypt. It's not that the Egyptians and the calf were destroyed in Egypt. The calf actually left Egypt, taking you with it.
I have a question. They came to Aaron and they said, you know, make gods for us to replace.
Make us a power of some sort,
now,
right?
He was the one who came up with the idea of asking them for their gold. Mm-hmm. If he hadn't asked for it, then it would have been a whole different thing.
That's right. So we said last week that the reason why he asked for gold is he thought it would slow them down. As if you would have asked them for wood, that then it would have been very. He knew that no one has any problem giving up wood, or I don't know what they had in the wilderness. But whatever, if he asked them for something that they would easily give away, then he wouldn't slow them down. But gold, he thought, would slow them down, and it didn't.
I mean, he might have thought of a different way to slow them down without asking them for things. He might have, you know, said.
Okay, so that's hard. That's hard to put ourselves in the moment over there. They're making demands, and they're expecting him to do something. So I'm not sure, you know, it seems like it seems like this was the strategy. You know, I don't know if any strategy would have worked, but this one didn't work.
This didn't work because they had it already.
Well, he told them, get the gold from your wives and children.
Yeah.
They took their own gold. They didn't, remember we said last week, they didn't even listen to him. The mob mentality here, they're not even listening to Aaron, even though they're going to Aaron, demanding something from Aaron, but they're not even trusting Aaron anymore because they're not listening to the instructions. They took their own gold. Yeah.
But he also then takes the gold and throws it into the fire to melt it.
Right.
So there's right. a purpose well, for that.
Right. Now, what would have happened had they you wouldn't have had any of these either black magic or the piece of metal thrown in? Well, what would have happened is you throw the gold in. Take some time to heat up. And then you got to take it. Like, I assume I've never done... What is it called? Smelting? Is that the word? I've never done it, but I imagine it is not a quick process. It takes some time. It takes some work. So I imagine, again, Aaron is looking for delay. Aaron's looking for something which is going to slow everybody down. But don't rush over here. It's going to take some time. Let's go home. Go eat dinner. You know, go watch some TV. And, well, you know, you'll come back later. Right? That's what he's trying to do over here. And every turn he makes, instead, the process is only sped up, and you end up with this calf. Once you have the calf, and you have the Egyptians claiming that this is the same calf that we worshipped in Egypt, the power of the calf has simply come up with us, along with the bones of Yosef. You brought the bones of Yosef out, well, the power of the calf has come with us. This is the same calf, and he's with us now. And so when you have that, and you have some Jews being drawn into it, now you've got a real problem. Now, at the end of the day, how many Jews actually worshipped the golden calf? It's a minority. It's a very small minority of the Jewish people. The Jewish people were, at lowest count, 2 million people. At lowest count. We know this because later there's going to be a census, and it's going to be 600,000 men between the ages of 20 and 60. So you've got to figure there are at least that many women. That's already 1.2 million. Then you got to deal with the children under 20, both boys and girls, and those over 60. So you're dealing with a minimum of 2 million people. So that's a lot of people. And how many people actually worshipped? So we don't have an exact count. But there were three types of people. There were those who worshipped and were neither warned nor were there witnesses. You have those who there were witnesses who saw them do it, but they weren't warned. And you have those who did it with warning and witnesses. We know that the third group, the warning and the witnesses, later on, Moshe is going to tell the Levim to kill those who did it. Those are the worst offenders. They were warned, there were witnesses, they didn't care, they did it anyway. How many people were the worst offenders? About, the Torah says, about 3,000. Now, 3,000 people is a lot of people. But when you put that in the context of 2 million people, yeah, it's not a gigantic amount of people. It's a nice-sized minority, but it's a minority nonetheless. Now, there were others, the ones who there were witnesses but weren't warned, and those who were neither warned nor witnessed, and they also got punished. So you've got to expand the numbers out a little bit. But you're not going to hit hundreds of thousands of people. That's not what it was. We're talking about if there were 3,000 who were the worst offenders, how many was it total? 10,000, 15,000, 20,000? But you're talking about 2 million people. So you're not dealing with more than 1% of the population. So
they were only men.
And it was only men, right? The women didn't do it. That's right. So you're dealing with 1% or less of the population. So was it a terrible sin? Yes, it was a terrible sin. It was one of the worst sins we ever committed. We're still paying for it today. Are the rest of the Jews held accountable for not stopping them? Yes, they are. Yes, they are. But when you talk about who actually worshipped, it's less than 1%. It's not more than 1% of the population. The question is, what's the expectation over there? Meaning that person says, Hur got up to stop them and he was killed. So, was he foolish, or did he do the right thing?
He didn't know that he was
going to
be killed, I'm sure.
Okay, but I'm saying, but in retrospect, did he do the right thing?
Yeah, he still did the right
thing. He did the right thing. apparently there was an expectation that everybody try to stop them. And had everybody gotten up to try to stop them, I imagine there would have been a civil war and several people would have been killed. But at the end of the day, the dastardly deed would have been stopped.
So just the fact that they didn't join in, isn't that a powerful message?
It's definitely better.
It's too passive.
But it's right. It's no different than absolving the German people, because they were just swept into the whole thing and they can't be blamed. That's not our perspective. They can very well be blamed. They should have risen up. But they would have been killed. Yes, lots of people would have been killed. But there should have been a civil war. That's what should have happened. And if it didn't happen, then they're culpable. Okay, so we will stop here.
Thank you.
For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. For those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site.